The Black Shore Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Good evening. You are listening to the Black Shore Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio. We are back for 2016. 2016, that's a bit crazy to say, but we are going to be bringing you all of the theatre over the next year, and also everything that Blackshore is going to be doing, all our shows, upcoming events, all the fun stuff. And we're kicking it off with a really packed show this week. We are going to be hearing a retro movie review from Matt and Vicky. This one is The Watchmen. We are also going to be casting our eye back over 2015 and listening to some of our best bits. I've chosen one of my favourite reviews and a few other bits. Vicky is also going to be doing her first ever Arts Thing of the Week of 2016. She's going to be talking about The Illusionists. And very excitingly, we are going to be hearing episode one of Great Expectations. So stay tuned for that. That's coming up in the second half of the show. But the first thing we're going to do is this. The Matt Boothman and Vicky Weston Retro.
Film review. So good, I put my trousers back on.
It's another retro movie review with Vicky and Matt. And we're going to talk about Watchmen. Which is a superhero movie from a few years ago, not very like the superhero movies we're getting at the moment. So it's based on a very well-regarded graphic novel by Alan Moore, and it's set in an alternative 80s. The sort of the hinge point for the alternative history is a scientific accident that creates a Superman, effectively known as Dr. Manhattan. And because he is created, the America wins Vietnam, and the sort of the civil revolts of the 70s and 80s go very differently, and a series of sort of costumed heroes arise, kind of inspired by Dr. Manhattan. So he is the reason for the creation of superheroes. But we actually join the story just after superheroes have been outlawed as vigilantes. And it is framed, at least at the beginning, as a kind of noir detective story. Members of the last superhero team to be disbanded are being bumped off, and we're trying to work out who's doing it. There are a lot more threads to this movie than that.
Yes, that is accurate. It deals a lot with the politics. It's quite interesting in the way that it deals with the politics of the actual 80s, the 80s that actually happened in our timeline, but through the lens of this alternate 80s.
Yeah, so sort of amplified.
Yes. Right?
So the fact that America has a literal Superman actually exacerbates the Cold War tension between America and Russia.
Yeah. There's a lot of reference to things like to clocks and time, and the doomsday clock is quite a heavy feature. And there's a fantastic Richard Nixon impression in it. It's just unbelievable. And there's a lot of stuff that's drawn from the reality of that time, and then it's threaded really cleverly. And this is done in the graphic novel as well. And Zack Snyder's kind of taken all of the threads and stitched them together brilliantly in the film. About what it would have been like in the 80s in this kind of other situation, but it actually does give you a kind of interesting perspective on the history of the time itself anyway.
Yeah, it's hugely thematically dense and ambitious for a superhero movie. You think of... they're getting a bit more sophisticated as time goes on, but you think of it as being, you know, people in tights punching each other. You talked about clocks, and it has this sort of extended meditation on godhood and the clockmaker analogy, and how that corresponds to Dr. Manhattan putting himself back together like a watchmaker. And I suppose mostly it's about superhumanness, and at what point you get so superhuman that you're actually not human anymore and can't empathise with the human condition. and who can actually, if the people who are supposedly keeping us safe are that superhuman they're not really human, then who can actually police them? So throughout you get you see lots of graffiti that says "Who watches the Watchmen," which is the slogan of the sort of anti superhero movement of the movie.
There are some quite interesting debates around the kind of, and this is relates to that kind of lack of humanity, which is that is it worth sacrificing the lives of millions to save the lives of billions, and the view in the sort of semi-villain of the film. And it's difficult because they're, unlike most superhero films, there is no goodies and baddies really, but the villain of the piece is his belief that this kind of utopia can be created through the sacrifice of several million lives, and in his mind that's justified. And then there are other members of this kind of superhero unit who feel very, very strongly that that's not the case.
It's a matter of scale, isn't it? So there are the most human characters, kind of the Night Owl and the Silk Spectre. They are perfectly happy beating up thugs in back alleys, whereas kind of the closer characters get to being superhuman and the bigger picture they can see, the less satisfied they get with that kind of superheroics and how little it actually changes in the grand scheme of things.
It kind of is an interesting meditation on like the point of kind of dealing with crime on a small scale, which obviously is the kind of point of a lot of superhero films that you'll know of, is mostly there is some kind of villain and the work is done to foil that villain's plot and everyone goes home happy at the end. That's the kind of general way it works. And in Watchmen, that's absolutely not the way it works. And that's why it's a kind of special superhero movie, because, spoilers now, they don't win out in the end and the villain gets his way and actually improves the world as a result of his actions.
As far as he sees it.
So that's instead of the world being thrown into some kind of total nightmare, although millions of people have lost their lives, there's actually this kind of perfect harmony existing worldwide as a result of his actions. So it kind of immediately brings into question that whole idea of right and wrong, and if there is this black and white divide between good and evil and right and wrong, and how you make those moral decisions is just quite an interesting way of looking at it.
And if he's at the top of that superhuman pyramid, there's Rorschach right at the very bottom, who almost becomes subhuman in order to try and improve things as he sees it. And it says something about the worldview of the movie, I think, that Rorschach is the closest you really get to a hero you can actually root for.
Yeah.
And he's a neoconservative nut.
Yes, he is.
Who absolutely believes that it's correct to murder criminals.
Yeah.
Throw people down elevator shafts and all sorts.
And that, I think he's got issues with kind of crime and prostitution, and genuinely believes that people kind of deserve what they get and make their own kind of destiny in that really kind of, as Matt says, neoconservative way. But yet, he's the one who seems to be most often kind of speaking the truth about the situation, at least from a kind of the viewer's standpoint as you watch the film.
He's set up as the one you can root for, partially because he's really the only one who never compromises on his value set.
Yeah. In fact, that's his kind of catchphrase, isn't it? Is this
no compromise.
And also he's the narrator, so to an extent he's sort of set up as the voice of the viewer and as a protagonist in some ways, even though you don't actually see his face until sort of nearly two-thirds of the way through the film. But he's a really interesting character. One of the things we wanted to talk about was how closely aligned it is to the graphic novel.
Yeah, and Zack Snyder's directorial style is always interesting to talk about because it's very Marmite. It turns out his sort of hand on the speed button, the speed dial, sort of speeding things up and slowing them down. His use of slow-mo and then overspeed and that kind of choreographed fight sequences, but very, very kind of again, uncompromisingly bloody as well.
Yes, and it is, yeah. He's very graphic, and one of the things I think is most interesting about it is that his style, as we know from 300 and other films that he's made, is very, very suited to the graphic novel adaptation genre, because he does all these fantastic still shots, which are just snapshots. And in this particular film, lots of them are direct shots from, you know, actual still cuts from the graphic novel, where you could literally lay the image from the graphic novel over the screen and it would be exactly the same. So his homage to the original novel is very, very accurate from that perspective.
And this movie has been criticised for being too slavish.
Mm.
As sort of slavish to the comic at the expense of it being a good movie. I actually think that the changes that's the most interesting thing to talk about, I think, is where he departs from the graphic novel, and particularly the ending, where he does choose an ending that kind of keeps the punch of the graphic novel without being so weird it would just make you throw your hands up and leave the cinema.
Yeah, the ending to the graphic novel, for those who haven't read it, is incredibly strange, and in a comic context, as in comic book context, it absolutely works, and it's totally fine.
It works, but it definitely feels like a curveball.
Yes.
And it's something you're completely not expecting, whereas the movie version of that ending feels a bit better set up and foreshadowed.
Yeah.
So it works better as a shorter.
Yeah, and I think like theatrically it makes sense. In the movie it makes sense. And I think one of the reasons why I'm very much okay with that departure from the novel, beyond the fact that actually it does work better, is that he is so faithful in so many other respects that you can tell he's making a departure because it's absolutely necessary to the quality of the film, not because he's just playing kind of God with Alan Moore's work.
Yeah. It's interesting rewatching it, because I don't think I've watched Watchmen since the sort of current golden age of superhero movies started. And it's very interesting watching it back after that, because it's so rare now to see a superhero movie that isn't attempting to set up or continue a franchise. Yeah. Maybe it is a bit overlong, maybe it is a bit sort of overly thematically dense, or maybe it's overly slavish, but it is a single piece of work that stands alone and tells a complete creates a complete world and tells a complete story without relying on references to other pieces of work.
Yeah, the only thing that's connected to it in any way is at the same time that the movie was released in cinemas, they released a DVD of a sub-story that's in the graphic novel called The Black Freighter, which has Gerard Butler in it. Because Zack Snyder loves Gerard Butler and couldn't get him into Watchmen. So I haven't seen that, actually. I'd be quite interested to get my hands on it. But that wasn't really there to make money. It was more there to satisfy the hardcore fans who would be saying that's a bit that's been cut.
Yeah,
because it's quite a substantial bit that's been cut. And again, cut for absolutely the right reasons, because it doesn't really have a lot of bearing on the plot.
It's interesting looking at it in the context of Zack Snyder's later superhero work as well, because you can see that the tone of Watchmen absolutely fits his style, whereas taking on a slightly more positive superhero like Superman...
Slightly more.
who is supposed to be a bit more actually upstanding and less morally grey, he can't seem to cope with someone who isn't morally grey.
Yeah.
He has to go and wade into those contradictions and give them to characters who maybe they're not appropriate for.
Yeah, I think that was always the problem with Man of Steel, was that Superman of all of the superheroes, I think, is the most kind of morally superior, partly because he's from like this superior race of beings, so it's kind of literally played out in his morality, but also because of the parents he's had and the upbringing he's had, and he's supposed to be this kind of character. And in Watchmen, you don't get any characters who are like that.
They're... Superman's almost the anti-Rorschach, because he sticks to his values in the same way as Rorschach, but they are completely opposite values.
Yeah, they are very much so. And
Much more faith in humanity.
And I think that's the Superman values that I think Zack Snyder sees as not very realistic, perhaps, and that Watchmen actually tells a more realistic, it's a more realistic tale of what would happen in a world where masked superheroes were kind of flying around dealing justice.
You were just listening to a retro film review by Matt and Vicky, and that was Watchmen. We're calling these retro film reviews for all of you who haven't heard these yet, only because they're not actually being played at the cinemas at the moment. So if you're getting a bit confused by why they fall into the retro category, we've just called them retro because they're not current, if that makes sense. Anyway, on the next show, you're going to be hearing Matt and Vicky talk about Old Boy, which is a fantastically crazy film. So tune in for that in a fortnight's time. I'm going to now play for you a fantastically produced little fun showreel of everything that the Black Shore Arts Hour achieved and all the fun that we had in 2015. This has been created by the wonderful Andrew Crane, and it is really fun to listen to.
The Black Shore Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Good evening. You are listening to the Black Shore Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio. In the studio with me this evening is Matt, our movie guy.
Hello.
And Ellie.
Hello.
And Vicky, back by popular demand.
Thank you very much.
Just my demand, really.
Yeah, no, just you. Yeah. You're popular, though, so it's sort of, like, has some kind of indirect...
Cheers, know. Buddy.
Yeah, thanks.
I do have sort of a deep love that goes beyond criticism for a lot of these movies. So I want you to know that any criticism I have of this movie comes from a good place. It comes from a place of love.
That's pretty intense.
Yeah.
I know, right? Ellie's not even seen the film and it's ridiculous already.
I feel like I'm getting the experience right now.
So this will be followed up by Avengers Infinity War Part 1 and Avengers Infinity War Part 2.
Oh, is there two more?
There are two more.
Oh. How can it be Infinity and only two parts?
It's a war about Infinity. I don't think it's a war that takes infinite time. It turns out it's, you know, like he's a room full of whips and handcuffs.
He's not...
bought a lot of stuff. Fair play to him. Like, he's got a lot
he's
of
really
stuff.
He's really committed
in that.
To it.
Yeah, like collection. That room is really, really well put together. But like that is fairly. Like, I don't know if I'm disclosing stuff about myself here, but that feels fairly vanilla to me. I got on with it more easily than I've been getting on with girls. Mm. Partly because... Yeah, thank you. Yeah, laugh it up.
I can let that one slide.
This next segment is one that we've done, I think, twice now. And it's still got a terrible name and it's still just called Arts Thing of the Week.
Hey, I like a thing that does what it says on the tin. I mean, anyone who knows me knows that I get a kind of real enjoyment out of things that are so bad they're good, and Eurovision is the perfect embodiment of something that is so bad it's good. Eurovision is my third favourite day of the year, after Christmas and Pancake Day.
Emily, do you relate to the character of Alice?
Probably more than I should do.
Is it because you're really curious?
I'm just so inquisitive. She's quite strothy, isn't she, Alice?
She is.
Do you get to kick it in the mouth?
I don't know.
It's quite hard to get up there.
Yeah, it's quite high.
They have called it a gift horse, though, so...
I don't think that's not the expression.
It's not don't kick a gift horse, it's don't look a gift horse in the mouth.
I've heard don't punch a gift horse in the mouth as well, so that's probably where I'm getting probably
wrong.
Why are
you being so nasty to horses?
General advice is to not
don't.
Hit
no, that, that's
horses.
What I said, don't do it, and that's why.
I guess that's goodbye.
That's it, that's it.
Yeah. I'd like to thank everyone in the studio for coming in tonight and helping me present the show. So thanks to Alex and Matt and Ellie. Thank you so much, Vicky, for coming in and presenting with me. Thanks for joining us, everyone.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for coming.
It's been fantastic.
No worries. It was a great pleasure.
And we will see you next week.
All right.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Welcome back to the Black Shore Arts Hour. You are listening to Wandsworth Radio. Obviously, because we do this show, I get to go and see a lot of films, which I enjoy sometimes, only if they're good films. And one of my particular favourites of last year was The Martian. And this is a few snippets of one of probably my favourite review that Matt Boothman did on the show last year. So here it is. Matt, you are doing The Martian, are you not?
I am. So The Martian is the newest addition to the Lost on Your Own in Space subgenre of movies. So a few years ago we had Moon by Duncan Jones, which was about Sam Rockwell being lonely on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And a few years ago, a bit more recently, we had Gravity by Alfonso Cuarón, which was about space being really hostile to Sandra Bullock. And now we have The Martian by Ridley Scott, adapted from the novel by Andy Weir, which is about Matt Damon Robinson Crusoed on Mars. So roughly speaking, Matt Damon is... Mark Watney, he's a botanist who's part of a science team studying Mars. something goes wrong, everybody has to leave. Mark Watney gets left behind and has to survive on Mars for long enough to signal home and get rescued.
Yes.
So where Moon was about sort of the psychological effects of the of loneliness and remoteness, and Gravity was about how hostile space is, the Martian's really about the ingenuity. It really focuses in on the creativity that you would have to survive that situation. And it's actually, it's an example of a sort of a grand old sci-fi tradition that has sort of gone out of fashion a little bit. The puzzle box story, where you set up a situation with a lot of problems and have the characters solve it using science. This used to be all the rage in science fiction, and it's sort of out of fashion now. This is a really good example of it. So it's sort of a great big thought experiment. It's Andy Weir has written this book basically asking, could somebody survive being marooned on Mars? What would they need to survive? What would they need to do? So he'd need to grow his own food. He'd need to create water to do that. He'd need to signal home, etc., etc., etc. What things going wrong could and couldn't he survive? So stepping back a bit from it, having watched it, the plot is sort of almost quite convenient for him, as much as everything seems to be going wrong, and every time he seems to be able to relax, something new goes wrong that he has to deal with. There's still, I noticed, he keeps talking about, if my air fails or if my water fails, I will die. And he mentions it so many times that I thought that one of them was going to fail at one point, and neither of them ever do. So it's sort of, the things that can go wrong without killing him for the plot, for plot purposes, do go wrong. So it's a bit convenient in that way, but it's all in service of showing how, if somebody was marooned, could we eventually get them back.
Yeah.
One of those things is, what sort of personality type would that person need? So Matt Damon plays this character who is, if you took it, put him in a different situation, you might think he was a bit full of himself.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah. So I interrupted you.
Because I suspect you were about to say you quite liked him, right?
Oh, yeah,
yeah,
so
I
much.
Really liked him as well. He had me from the line, Mars will come to fear my botany powers.
He's so funny as well. Yeah. And I think that really comes out of the writing. From what I've heard from people reading the book, he's a hilariously funny character, and the reason you really want him to succeed is because he is so funny and fun, and he takes the piss out of the situation he finds himself in.
Yeah, so he does a lot of these sort of diary pieces to camera, to all the cameras in his habitat that he's living in on Mars, which there was a point where I thought, who is he actually doing these for? Because he's explaining everything in terms that the audience of the movie can understand. And I'm thinking,
us sitting in the cinema.
Because if he's leaving these for the next crew to come back to Mars, then why is he putting it all in layman's terms? Because surely they'll all be astronauts. But
what you've done there, Matt, is you've actually thought logically about film, and that you're not allowed to do that. You can't. That's not right.
Well, I mean, I explained it away as he's doing it for his own benefit. He's sort of talking to himself take himself through his own thought process and stop himself going crazy.
Yes,
effectively. What's interesting is, unlike those other movies I talked about, it wouldn't actually be that much of a big deal if he was annoying, or if you did find those sort of verbal tics or his turns of phrase irritating, because it's not like Moon, where Sam Rockwell is literally the only character in the entire movie. Only about half of the Martian is with Matt Damon on Mars, and for the rest, we get the rescue effort back on Earth and the ship full of his shipmates heading back to Earth without him. And so it is actually a movie about everybody coming together to solve this problem.
Team.
Exactly. And it's a fantastically diverse...
That was some fantastic input from Ellie. Yeah.
Yeah, it's cheerleading. It does, and it makes you want to cheerlead everybody in it and cheer them on to achieve what they want to achieve. It's a fantastically diverse movie. It's sort of an international effort to try and bring this astronaut home. And
is there a lot of camaraderie?
There's a lot of camaraderie.
There is. Oh, you would like it, yeah. Ellie. Ellie does
have a little cry.
Yeah.
There's a lot of women and people of colour in prominent sort of scientist type roles.
Well done.
Yep. General scientist job role. Yep. Yes.
Loads of women defined by their role, and we've talked about this a lot on the show before, defined by their role rather than by their relationship to a man.
We're going to talk about that more later as well, particularly with science because of Photograph 51.
Themes. And so one of the things that's interesting about it is it's sort of a it's been described in the press materials as it's a movie without a baddie. It's all the different people might have different ideas about the best way to bring Watney home, and there is certainly some character conflict between, for instance, I think it's Jeff Daniels and Sean Bean's characters clash over what is the best strategy.
Wait. Does Sean Bean survive the film?
Sean Bean survives
the film. I'm sorry, but this is one thing that I'm going to throw out there. He does survive. Also, I cannot understand a word that man is saying. What is going on with that?
What, because he's off of Yorkshire?
No, it's not even that. He just mumbles. He just mumbles the whole way through this film.
Is he trying to do an accent, or is he just...
No!
He's himself.
I think he's playing a character. But that character is a mumbling.
It's much better
Yorkshireman.
Well, but maybe he was trying to not be so Sean Bean, so he didn't get killed in the film.
But then he just became even more Sean Bean by just mumbling the entire. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, he is a sort of a curmudgeon.
he's
the one who's putting the crew's mental well-being at the heart of everything, rather than sort of the cold equations of can we make the science work.
I think in saying, like what you said about not being a baddie, I hadn't actually thought about that. But in watching the film, Jeff Daniels, who plays the head of NASA...
He's the head of NASA, yeah.
Yeah. He sort of jumped out to me as being the bad guy, because he was kind of, you know, not thinking about the well-being of... I think in so many words he says, let's just leave him there.
He sort of says, let's leave him there longer in order to not endanger more people. Like, he's still...
Yeah.
This is the way I saw it was, he's still working towards wanting to bring him home, but trying to do it with the least risk to other people. So he's definitely the... If you were going to boo someone, it's him. And he's definitely the conservative and sort of the risk-averse person. But equally, he's the one that you keep seeing on the press podiums having to justify everything that they're doing, and having to get up and make the embarrassing speech that, oh, the guy we thought we was dead is actually marooned on Mars.
Yeah, we left him there.
Yeah.
Whoops. It's so funny because I wanted to hate this film so much. You have no idea how much I wanted to hate it, because, you know, notoriously I don't like things that are about space. But I think I liked this because... A, Matt Damon's fantastic in it. B, the script is brilliant, I thought. And C, it's not really that much about space, really. It's just about Mars. And it's about, you know, him, as you said, problem solving his way through, you know, all these quite ludicrous situations. And, you know, just being really charming about it. And I just really want to have a beer down the pub with him. And
I've got another theory about maybe why you liked it.
Why?
Because Matt said there wasn't a particular enemy, but maybe the enemy is space. And so if space is the bad guy, you like the film.
Well, now.
Ba-ba-ba.
That's interesting. But yeah, definitely, I think out of the bad guy conversation, Mars is the bad guy, or space. That's the answer to that question.
Yeah, Vicky suggested when we were having this conversation before the show... the only other movie that came to mind that has that similar setup is things like The Day After Tomorrow, where the environment is the bad guy and everybody's just trying to survive.
And like Twister and Tornado and all those.
But equally, those are disaster movies where everyone's trying to survive, as opposed to they all have a goal that they're trying to achieve by working together.
Yeah, but you could essentially say that a lot of the people in this film are trying to survive, like make him survive.
Yeah.
So it's sort of an extension survival mechanism of him, you know, going out to everyone else, which I think is interesting. Can we talk a little bit? You guys will really like this. The soundtrack of this film is so like, if I say it to you, it's all disco. And it's a funny joke because basically
it's
Matt
Jessica Damon's, Chastain's character.
Yeah, so she's the
she's the head of the science team, effectively.
Yes, so she's like the big captain of the ship, and she's the only one that was allowed to bring music, apparently. and he's just stuck with all of her disco, and he listens to it throughout the whole, like, it just soundtracks the whole film brilliantly, and yeah. It's hilarious because he's just, like, you know, dancing around and trying to grow potatoes. It's such a good film. Please go and see it. I'm taking on Matt's role this week. I'm like, go and see this film. It's really good.
It's doing really well, so it seems like a lot of people have already taken that advice. But yeah, go. It's worth a watch.
Now, I've never been to see a pantomime in the UK. I've never seen a pantomime anywhere, actually, ever. But my friend Corey Holes has, and he wrote this review last year when he went and saw his first ever pantomime. And because it's just past Christmas and there's still pantomimes running in London up until January, I thought I'd play it again and give you an idea of what pantomime seems like from the eyes of an Australian.
Matt Damon has had a wide and varied film career, and I can count myself as a fan of almost all his films, aside from the movie Green Zone, which I've not seen, nor do I intend to see, despite the many unforeseen changes my life and personal taste could undergo in the future. Digressions aside, as I was midway through the pantomime version of Jack and the Beanstalk, put on by Epsom Theatre, for some reason my enjoyment of the play was compounded 100-fold by my recalling of the Matt Damon film Rounders and the film's tagline, "In the game of life, play the cards you're dealt." Unfortunately, I've gone a bit Scorsese and begun to recap my adventure into the world of English pantomime in media res, so let me go back to where most good pantomimes start, at the beginning. Having only been exposed to the deep, dark world of pantomime through Ricky Gervais' show Extras and his hardly glowing portrayal of a pantomime version of Aladdin, which made the medium look slightly more enjoyable than watching 48 hours of competitive curling, seeing a pantomime was not at the top of my list of things to do when I arrived in the motherland from Australia. So when a co-worker and friend informed me that he was in a play, I thought that it would not only be terrific to go and support him, but also could be some unbelievable ammunition for my sniper-like wit. In other words, pantomime would not know what hit it when my elegant and amusing prose sent it packing back so far down the theatre pecking order that it would soon be begging to have as much respect as mime or those dudes who stand still on the street for hours with paint on them. This is the mindset with which I travelled the not inconsiderable journey from London to the Epsom Theatre. I had worked myself into so much of a "I can't wait to have a sarcasm explosion all over this panto's recap" that I actually was in danger of blowing some of my jokes too early. I was getting so excited that I was throwing witty barbs at the Wetherspoons waiter who served us our edible food. You could barely hear the fruit machines over my mic drop. By the time I'd gotten into the theatre, I'd legitimately worked myself into a veritable frenzy akin to an atheist commenter on a Hillsong Church YouTube channel. It was an accepted reality in my mind that this would be the worst thing I had ever seen with my two eyes, so I was just sitting waiting for the theatrical stench to wash over me like one of the dust clouds in Interstellar. Imagine to my horror then that not only did I more than enjoy the preceding 2.5 hours of pantomime theatre, but I was literally touched how not one person in the theatre, despite the ridiculousness of what was being displayed, chose to react with snark. In a day and age where caustic remarks and sarcasm are almost second nature to most people, and a protective screen most people put up to ensure that they are not seen committing to the enjoyment or having an emotional response to anything at all. For further proof of this, attend a concert of a band rated higher than 7.5 on Pitchfork at a venue that is located near any kind of cafe that has found furniture. The groups of people that were in attendance at the play itself were enigmatically antithetic at best. Groups of teenage friends, young couples on dates, full families, apparently a hen's night, and all of the children in the area unlucky enough not to be chosen as one of the 450 extras on stage, made for an active, engaged, winking, and most importantly, snark-free audience. In fact, this change took a little while to catch on with me, as I still myself attempted to make snippy comments with the friend I attended the show with, who I had envisaged being akin to a catcher for my 100-mile-per-hour fastballs or my banter about the panto. However, it seems she too was not immune to the genuine magic of the pantomime. I remarked early on, more out of frustration, that I was not responding to one of the actors, saying, "I really don't like her." This was met with a completely earnest, "You're not meant to like her. She's the villain of the play." It was clear my negative mindset could not last any longer. I began to think of Matt Damon and the tagline aforementioned. Oftentimes when I gamble in games like poker, I used to get stuck on hands I wanted to play, tried to force the cards. I would not adapt to how the cards were being played on the table. This is why I'm a terrible player. And with this, there is also a distinct parallel with my initial foray into pantomime theatre. As I said, I was attempting to dislike the play, as I believed that this would make for more lols, when really, I should have just played the cards I was dealt in the game of life, or pantomime in this case, and enjoyed the lols right in front of my face. The pantomime was well directed, well put together, fantastically acted, incredibly performed from a musical perspective, and more than anything else, there were some genuinely funny moments, both for the kids and for the adults. Let me be clear, from an outsider's perspective, I still think it was one of the craziest things that I've ever seen. Things that I guess are standard in a normal pantomime just plain confused me, but nevertheless, this confusion did not annoy me or provide material for me like I had forecasted. Instead, just added another layer of mystique to the fairy tale. I'm of course under no illusion that this was not Shakespeare. My enjoyment of the piece may have been heightened by the fact that my expectations were at such a low level that any small surface improvement made the play seem like the hottest girl in school. That's right, in this analogy, the pantomime is the character of Lady Boggs in She's All That. And while the comparison may be interesting to say the least, spare a thought for me while seeing this play. Like the movie Rounders, I was playing the hand that life dealt me and I was all in. I was enjoying the play, particularly the amount of delicious puns as well as the slightly absurdist and meta-humour that must have been going over the head of the 2 4-year-old girls who were sat in front of me. They seemed entirely too distracted by their light-up wands to notice the meta-textual jibes taking place on stage. Anyway, as I said, I'd leaned into Jack and the Beanstalk, that is, until, like the giant in the final stanza, I came crashing down to earth. This occurred when a 12-foot puppet slash man on stilts appeared with a 3-foot head as the giant on stage and started dancing to All About That Bass. While the children in front of me almost inserted their wand into their mother's eye out of sheer excitement, this was a bridge too far for me to accept. And I mean literally. It took me almost 3 days to come to terms with actually seeing it in my eyes, and that the moderately priced polo mints at Epsom Theatre I was devouring did not contain some kind of hallucinogen. This, however, was only one of the weak points for me in a strong play, and mainly because I'm still not entirely sure it took place. Weaker points aside, I still thoroughly enjoyed the pantomime. I went all in, and won a large figurative pot back. Will I return to a pantomime anytime soon? Well, as Kenny Rogers' immortal words about gambling state, with the pantomime subtext, I'm sure, you gotta know when to walk away. With this pure, magical theatrical experience in my back pocket, and a slightly brighter worldview, I think I've counted my chips and folded for the time being. But if there is anyone out there doing an exploratory look into English pantomime from an Australian perspective, and has expectations set very low, or just a normal non-cynic who enjoys fun and laughter, then I cannot personally recommend pantomime enough.
Now, Vicky Weston has been producing fantastic arts things of the week, since we just came up with the idea of Arts Thing of the Week, which still needs a bit of reworking, but we just haven't managed to get around to it. But, you know, it's kind of rough around the edges. It is what it is, I suppose. This week, she is talking about The Illusionists.
I've always thought that theatre was magical, but when I went to see The Illusionists, which is currently showing at the Shaftesbury Theatre recently, I was inspired to make my Arts Thing of the Week magical too. More than mere tricks, The Illusionist was a theatrical feast for the senses, incorporating pretty much every possible theatre wizardry you can imagine, and probably some you can't. There were some bits where I thought, ah, I know what they're doing, how they're doing that, and what's going on there, but plenty more bits where my mind was completely blown. The show is totally suitable for children and a marvellous introduction into all the different types of magic that exist. Each illusionist has a name for the type of magic that they do. For example, an inventor with elaborate set and prop-heavy steampunk illusions, a deductionist with a Sherlockian approach to magic, and of course the classic Houdini-style escapologist, the most tense and incredible 4 minutes of the entire show, for his classic underwater escape. There's also a Japanese manipulator doing some of the most nimble and dexterous sleight of hand I think you will ever see. This particular section of the show was incredibly beautiful and made great use of the simplicity and beauty of theatre. The show made absolutely incredible use of the amazing technical trickery theatre has to offer, and from that perspective I found the show to be a real testament to the mind-blowing craft of stage managers and technical theatre designers, as well as illustrating how far innovation in stage technology will allow you to go nowadays. They employed classic theatre methods that have been in use since the ancient Greeks, as well as some seriously up-to-date whiz-bangery. For me, the combination of magic and theatre made the theatrical experience all the more theatrical and the magic seem more magical. If you're fascinated by stagecraft or just love being amazed by magic, it's definitely one to watch.
So linking magic right back into this very show that you are listening to, I gave Andrew Crane, our fantastic sound man, one of the hardest editing tasks I think he's ever had to do. I'm saying that with a bit of trepidation because I'm not sure if he's had to do anything more difficult. But basically, we recorded the entirety of an adapted Great Expectations, which had been adapted for the stage, and then we recorded it for the radio. And Andy had to basically edit it into 7 parts, which he has managed to do. And it is so impressive and slightly magical. And this is the first time that we're playing it on the radio. And it's been so highly anticipated since we actually started this project back in, I think, September of 2015. So it's been quite a work in progress since then. And it's really nice to have something that we can actually play for you, which is going to run for the next 7 shows on the Black Shore Arts Hour. So without further ado, here is episode 1 of Great Expectations.
Great Expectations, episode 1.
My father's family name being Pirrip, and my Christian name Philip, my infant tongue could make of both names nothing longer or more explicit than Pip. So I called myself Pip, and came to be called Pip. My first, most vivid and broad impression of the identity of things seems to have been gained on a memorable raw afternoon towards evening. At such a time, I found out for certain that this bleak place, overgrown with nettles, was the churchyard, and that Philip Pirrip, late of this parish, and also Georgiana, wife of the above, were dead and buried, and that the dark, flat wilderness beyond the churchyard, intersected with dikes and mounds and gates, with scattered cattle feeding on it, was the marshes, and that the low, leaden line beyond was the river, and that the small bundle of shivers growing afraid of it all and beginning to cry was Pip.
Hold your noise! Keep still, you little devil, or I'll cut your throat!
A fearful man, all in coarse grey with a great iron on his leg. A man who had been soaked in water and smothered in mud, and whose teeth chattered in his head as he seized me by the chin.
Oh, don't cut my throat, sir. Pray don't do it, sir.
Tell us your name. Quick, Pip, sir. Once more, give it me.
Pip, sir.
Where's your mother?
There, sir.
Where?
No, there, sir. Also, Georgiana. That's my mother.
Oh. And is that your father along to your mother?
Yes, sir. Him too, late of this parish.
Who do you live with? Supposing you be kind and let to live, which I ain't made up my mind about.
My sister, sir. Mrs. Joe Gardery, wife of Joe Gardery, the blacksmith, sir.
Blacksmith, eh? Now, looky here. You know what a file is?
Yes, sir.
And you know what whittles is?
Yes, sir.
You bring me, tomorrow morning early, that file and them whittles. You do it, and you never dare to say a word or dare to make a sign concerning your having seen such a person as me, and you shall be let live. You fail, and your heart and your liver shall be torn out, roasted, and ate. Now, I ain't alone as you may think I am. There's a young man hid with me, in comparison with which young man, I am a angel. Now, what do you say?
Yes, sir.
Say, Lord strike you dead if you don't.
Lord strike me dead if I don't.
Now, You remember what you've undertook and you get home.
Good night, sir.
Much of that. I wish I was a frog or an eel.
My sister, Mrs. Jo Gargery, with black hair and eyes, had such a prevailing redness of skin that I sometimes used to wonder whether it was possible she washed herself with a nutmeg grater instead of soap. She was more than 20 years older than I, and had established a great reputation with herself and the neighbours because she had brought me up by hand. Joe was a fair man, with curls of flaxen hair on each side of his smooth face, and with eyes of such a very undecided blue that they seemed to have somehow got mixed with their own whites.
Mrs. Joe has been out a dozen times looking for you, Pip, and she's out now making it a baker's dozen.
Is she?
Yes, Pip. And what more, Pip? She's got Tickler with her. She sat down and she got up and she made a grab at Tickler and she rampaged out. That's what she did.
Tickler was a wax-ended piece of cane worn smooth by collision with my tickled frame.
She's coming. Get behind the door, old chap, and have the jacktail betwixt you.
Where have you been, you young monkey?
I've only been to the churchyard.
Churchyard? If it weren't for me, you'd have been to the churchyard long ago and stayed there. Who brought you up by hand?
You did.
And why did I do it, I should like to know? Churchyard, indeed. You'll drive me to the churchyard betwixt you one of these days, and oh, a precious pair you'd be without me.
It was Christmas Eve, and I had to stir the pudding for the next day with a copper stick from 7 to 8 by the Dutch clock.
Hark! Was that great guns, Joe?
Ah, there is another con whipped off.
What does that mean, Joe?
Escaped.
What's a convict?
There was a convict off last night, after sunset gun. And now it appears they're firing warning of another.
But who's firing?
Drat that boy, what a questioner he is. Ask no questions, and you'll be told no lies.
Mrs. Joe, I should like to know, if you wouldn't mind much, where the firing comes from.
Lord bless the boy! From the hulks.
And please you, what's hulks?
Answer him one question and he'll ask you a dozen directly. Hulks are prison ships, right across the meshes.
I wonder who's put into prison ships and why they're put there.
People are put in the hulks because they murder. And because they rob and do all sorts of bad. And they always begin by asking questions. Now get you along to bed.
As I went upstairs in the dark, I felt fearfully sensible of the great convenience that the hulks were handy for me. I was clearly on my way there. I had begun by asking questions, and I was going to rob Mrs. Joe. As soon as the great black velvet pall outside my little window was shot with grey, I got up. I stole some bread, some brandy, and a beautiful compact pork pie. I unlocked and unbolted the door to the forge and got a file from among Joe's tools. Then I ran for the misty marshes. It was a rimy morning and very damp. The mist was heavier yet when I got out upon the marshes, so that instead of running at everything, everything seemed to run at me. I had just crossed a ditch when I saw the man sitting before me. His back was towards me and was nodding forward, heavy with sleep.
Sir? Sir?
Yeah. He instantly jumped up, and it was not the same man, but another man.
The young man.
He made a hit at me, a weak blow that missed me and almost knocked himself down. And then he ran into the mist.
What's in the bottle, boy?
Brandy, sir. I think you've got the ague.
I'm much of your opinion.
It's bad about here. You've been lying out in the meshes and the dreadful ague-ish.
I'll eat my breakfast afore they're the death of me. You're not a deceiving imp. You brought no one with you.
No, sir, no.
Well, I believe you.
I'm afraid you won't leave any of it for him.
Leave any for him? Who's him?
The young man. That was hit with you.
Oh, him, yeah, yes, yeah. He don't want no whittles.
I thought he looked as if he did.
Looked? When?
Just now.
Where?
Yonder. Over there, where I found him nodding asleep and thought it was you. Dressed like you, you know, only with a hat and with the same reason for wanting to borrow a file.
This man, did you notice anything in him?
He had a badly bruised face.
Where is he? Show me the way he went. I'll pull him down like a bloodhound. Curse this iron on me, sore leg. Give us a hold of the file, boy.
We were to have a superb Christmas dinner. And Uncle Pumblechook, Joe's uncle, but Mrs. Joe appropriated him, was to dine with us.
Besides, boy, think what you've got to be grateful for.
Do you hear that? Be grateful.
Why is it that the young are never grateful?
Naturally vicious.
Especially be grateful, boy, to them which brought you up by hand.
Now, to finish such a delightful and delicious present of Uncle Bumblechook's. It's a pie, a savoury pork pie.
Mm. Oh, heavens, it had come at last.
You shall have some, Pip.
I was lost. Mrs. Joe would find the pie missing.
Gracious! Goodness gracious me! What's gone with the pie?
I felt that I could bear no more, that I must run away.
Hey, you look sharp.
I had run head foremost into a party of soldiers.
Excuse me. I'm on a chase in the name of the king and I want the blacksmith. You see, blacksmith, we've had an accident with some handcuffs and I find the lock of them, one of them goes wrong. Will you throw your eye over them?
Convict, sergeant.
Aye, two. They're pretty well known to be out on the marshes still and I won't try to get clear of them before dusk. Anybody here seen anything of such game?
No.
Well, blacksmith, if you're ready, his majesty the king is.
Then Joe began to hammer and clink, and we all looked on. At last, Joe's job was done. As Joe got on his coat, he proposed that we should go down with the soldiers and see what came of the hunt. When we were out upon the dismal wilderness, I considered for the first time with great dread if we should find them. Would my particular convict suppose that it was I who had brought the soldiers here?
I got you now!
Convicts! Run away! Help! Somebody! Somebody!
Here are both men! Surrender you two and confound you two for wild beasts! Come asunder!
Mind, I took him. I give him up to you, mind that.
It's not much to be particular about. It'll do you small good, my man.
I don't expect it to do me any good. I took him, he knows it, that's enough for me.
Take notice, Gus. He tried to murder me, but bear witness.
Look here. Single-handed, I got clear of that prison ship. I made a dash and I done it. And I could have got clear of these death-cold flats likewise if I hadn't made discovery that he was here. Let him go free. Let him profit by the means as I found out. Let him make a fool of me afresh and again. No.
He tried to murder me. I should have been a dead man if you had not come up.
He lies! He's a liar born and he'll die a liar. Let him turn his eyes of his on me. I defy him to do it. Do you see him? Do you see what a villain he is? Do you see those grovelling and wandering eyes? That's how he looked when we was tried together. He never dared look at me.
You are not much to look at.
As one of the soldiers approached with the repaired handcuffs, my convict looked round him for the first time and saw me. I had been waiting for him to see me, that I might try to assure him of my innocence. He gave me a look that I did not understand, and it all passed in a moment. But if he had looked at me for an hour or for a day, I could not have remembered his face ever afterwards as having been more attentive.
I would like to say something regarding this escape. It may prevent some persons from laying under suspicion along with me. A man can't starve. At least I can't. I took some whittles up at the village over yonder from the blacksmiths. It was some broken whittles. That's what it was, and a dram of liquor and a pie.
Have you happened to miss such an article as a pie, blacksmith?
So you're the blacksmith, are you? Then I'm sorry to say, I've eaten your pie.
God knows you're welcome to it, so far as it was ever mine. We don't know what you have done, but we wouldn't have you starve to death for it. Poor miserable creature, would us, Pip?
We saw him out into the boat. By the light of the torches, we saw the black hulks lying out a little way from the mud of the shore, like a wicked Noah's Ark. We saw the boat go alongside, and we saw him taken up the side and disappear. Then the ends of the torches were flung hissing into the water and went out, as if it were all over with him.
Now, obviously, we will be recapping at the beginning of every episode of Great Expectations that we do play on the show. But to make sure that you never miss an episode, because it is going for 7 episodes, make sure that you subscribe to our podcast, for We Are a Podcast. We are the Blackshaw Arts Hour. You can search us on iTunes or just type it into Google. Blackshaw Theatre is literally everywhere, all over the internet. We're blackshawonline.com. If you want to head over there, and there's links to the podcast from our website. So do that, and you can hear the next episode of Great Expectations on the 17th of January. So that brings us to the end of the first show for 2016, which is quite terrifying. But we will be back with you in a fortnight. So on the 17th of January, we'll be playing another retro movie review, which is Oldboy. I'm going to be playing for you my favourite arts thing of the week that Vicky did in 2015. Helen has also been to see some things, so she's going to be talking about those things. And of course, we'll be playing the second episode of Great Expectations. So tune in then, and we will be back with you on Wandsworth Radio as the Blackshaw Arts Hour.